Chapter 7. Revision of aptitude requirements for further study in non-stationer languages and literatures. High scores on pattern recognition and memory capacity are no longer sufficient in and of themselves for progress beyond the intermediate levels offered to all LaSalle citizens. For promotion to the advanced courses, students should also display high aptitudes in group cohesion and social integration with both peers and adults, and have already completed a preparatory, intermediate plus, course in stationer history and culture. Preferably the same course recommended to prospective members of the Heritage Board. Aptitude and Educational Requirements Handbook for Stationers, ages 13 to 18. Revised edition. Issued by the Heritage Board of LaSalle Station under the authority of Aknel Amnadbat, Counselor for Heritage. Your tongue is a chrysanthemum, because all your words are petals. At the heart of language is a stem that balances a thousand syllables. Add a prefix to say mine. Add a suffix to say why. Add an infix to say what. And see how tongue becomes language. Takes Kalanli Rhyming Grammar. Prepared for Cray students by 17 Frame. Information Ministry, Education Division. In common use. Mahit had let herself think she was going to get off station entirely clear, if not entirely clean. Never clean. Getting away clean was an impossibility. Teix Kalan had taught her that. Teix Kalan and Yaskander. And now Daj Taratz was proving it to her again. She might manage to get on that shuttle Three Seagrass had called and leap from an immediate danger into a merely probable one. She might not die under alien gunfire. Sometimes people didn't. And yet here she was, inches from the just-landed Teix Kalanli shuttle, and staring down Aknel Amnadbat herself, who had somehow, through ill luck or profound cleverness or both, captured Three Seagrass. Mahit could hear her heartbeat in her ears, like rushing water, too fast and too loud. She was going to faint, or she was going to break and run for the shuttle, one or the other. And Three Seagrass and Amnadbat were coming toward her like a slow and terrible wave, too large a problem to outpace. Even having Dekakel Anchu standing right next to her wouldn't do her a bit of good. Anchu had made it perfectly clear that Mahit's usefulness to her was over. It had ended the moment she decided to not immediately mention that she'd received Anchu's secret notes to Yaskander when she'd returned to LaSalle a month ago. Anchu would hand her over to Amnadbat if Amnadbat asked nicely. Pilots needed heritage to keep approving new pilot Imago lines, since so many were being lost to the aliens out by the Anhamamet Gate. Anchu was here because she was supervising the exit of a Teix Kalanli ship from LaSalle Station, and making sure it stayed gone. Not for Mahit. This little scene was all politics, and Mahit wasn't a player here. She was a spent and useless resource to everyone but Daj Taratz, who only cared enough to let her go, not keep her safe, and to Three Seagrass, who was looking at her with clear and determined and furious eyes as Amnadbat steered her across the hangar bay. With icy clarity, Mahit thought, if I run, I think they may try to kill her for a spy. And icier still, she might be a spy, and I need to get her off my station and me with her.
You're a spy yourself now, Yaskander murmured,
and she ignored him. She couldn't think about what she'd promised Daj Taratz. Not now. Not until after this. If there was an after this, which contained sufficient time to contemplate what a person promised in extremity. What a person promised when they were half letting their imago lead them into choices they would never have made before they were part of a chain of living memory. Counselor, she found herself saying, surprised by the ease of her own voice, the smooth, unshaking confidence she felt none of. Her own tonality, this time, not Yaskander. All her, and yet that perfect serenity. What an unexpected surprise. It will save me leaving a message with your secretary. I've been unavoidably called away and will have to postpone my uploading appointment.
any minute now. Amnar Bhatt was going to say, "No, Mahit, come with me at once." And there would be heritage security personnel, emerging from the shadows like the Tixkalanli judiciary's missed agents, melting into visibility and taking her away. Any minute now, Amnar Bhatt was going to say, "See, Dasmar is compromised and she has allowed this Tixkalanli agent into our station." And possibly she wouldn't even be wrong. Any minute now. "Where is it that you have been called away to so urgently?" asked Aknil Amnar Bhatt, mild and colorless as distilled water.
"I am afraid, Counselor Amnar Bhatt," said Three Seagrass in Tixkalanli, "that it is my duty to reclaim the services of the ambassador from Lassell Station to Tixkalan."
The language felt wrong to Mahit for the first time in a long time. Out of context, Three Seagrass in bright flame orange, Tixkalan Litzlam perfect, was like a cut poisonous flower in the center of the hangar. Something beautiful and dangerous, that shouldn't be where it was, that would die, and in its dying take what was nearby with it. Amnar Bhatt glanced from Three Seagrass to Mahit, to the waiting shuttle, its doors open. Her eyebrows raised and her mouth pursed like she'd tasted citrus flavoring powder straight from the packet. And then she let go of Three Seagrass's arm. "I wonder if there'll be bruises," Mahit thought.
"You might get a chance to find out if you don't make any sudden movements," Iskander whispered.
And there was something utterly filthy in how he said it that made Mahit want to hide from the inside of her own mind. Had that inflection been hers or his? Both? How hard was it going to be to tell going forward? Amnar Bhatt did not speak in Tixkalanli, even though Mahit knew she could use the language perfectly well. But she must also have known that Three Seagrass couldn't understand much stationer at all.
"Is that so, Dasmar? Are you headed back to the Empire, despite owing your home the repository of your memory?"
Mahit winced. "We're going to the war, not the city. Counselor." That plural. She should watch her plurals. She'd meant her and Three Seagrass, surely. Iskander, a flicker of the younger, damaged version, less purient, more vicious.
"We" is an appropriate singular for us.
Mahit wished both of them would let her think, and also wished she hadn't wished it. She'd wanted him back so badly when he'd been gone. Amnar Bhatt looked her over, and looked Anshu next to her over, too. There was a vast judgment in that gaze, and a sense of utter disregard.
"Well, if you want, what use are you anyway?"
Mahit was projecting. Almost certainly. Assigning narrative where there wasn't any. She didn't seem to be able to stop. She hadn't been able to stop since the city. But then Amnar Bhatt said, still in stationer,
"There are so many easier ways to commit suicide, Dasmar, than going to someone else's war."
Mahit didn't think that barb was pointed at her, at all. It was for Anshu, and maybe for Dajtaratz through Anshu. Someone else's war. A waste of Lassell's resources again, at the mercy of Tixkalanli whims.
"If you hadn't threatened me, I wouldn't be going. I didn't mean to leave Lassell. I just came home. I came home, Counselor."
Thought was cheap.
"I expect to be back, alive," Mahit said. "Anything else, Counselor?"
Now, surely, would come the security personnel. Or Anshu would step in. Or Three Seagrass would stop looking like she could suddenly develop telepathy and tell Mahit what to do if she glared with sufficient expression.
"Oh, go on, then," said Aknil Amnar Bhatt,
easy as anything, and waved a hand at the shuttle.
"Enjoy yourself, while you've got breath for it."
She gave Three Seagrass a pat on the shoulder. Three Seagrass visibly flinched.
"Anshu, a word while the Tixkalanli Litzlam and her charge get out of our controlled space?" Of course, Counselor, said Anshu smoothly. Good luck, Mahid. And good luck to you as well, Envoy.
Anshu, at least, had bothered to revert to Tixkalanli when directly addressing Three Seagrass. She also had the wherewithal to immediately walk away from where she and Mahid had been standing, drawing Omnarbat along with her in her wake. These little things, a Tixkalanlitslim, a broken ambassador, all of that was not important when one counselor of Lascelles was having a conversation with another. It was blunt. Blunt and skillful. Mahid could imagine growing into a woman like that, if she lived so long. The open door of the shuttle looked like a dark mouth. Mahid picked up her luggage, less than she'd taken to the city, by far, and walked into it, Three Seagrass just behind her to the left, snapping back into place like a detached limb suddenly remade. As if they had never stopped being ambassador and liaison, barbarian and opener of doors. As if everything hadn't changed. Eight Antidote woke up with the Emperor standing in the frame of his bedroom window, moonlight thick behind her. She glowed like a dream apparition, a ghost, dressed in the white she'd worn before she'd been made emperor. Eight Antidote wondered if he'd woken a year ago, if the entire world he'd fallen into after his ancestor the emperor killed himself would dissolve into dream smoke, fade to nothing. Maybe he was 10 years old. Maybe all that would happen today was that he'd go see the palace hummers in their garden and recite poetry for his tutor, and avoid whoever the other child who had been provided for him to socialize with was, and forget. 19 Ads was watching him. The world as it was refused to slip away into half-recalled snatches. He was 11, and sole imperial heir, and yesterday he'd convinced the Minister of War to show him how to be a commander.
I have something I want to show you, said 19 Ads.
The weight of her eyes was very heavy. She was paying all of her attention to him right now, and he was in bed without a shirt on. Abruptly, he was embarrassed and pulled the sheet up to his chest as he sat up.
Your brilliance?
He said, trying not to sound like he'd been asleep just a minute ago, or too much like a kid. She came away from the window, a shadow separating. She had something in one hand, a sharp something, metal. Eight Antidote couldn't understand the shape of it. Maybe it was a knife. Maybe she was going to stab him and keep the Sunspear throne for herself and her heirs, whoever they would be, forever. Could he stop her? 11 Laurel had taught him basic grappling, and he knew how to use an energy pistol, but he didn't have an energy pistol. And 19 Ads outweighed him twice over, and also he was lying down and she was standing up, so she had all the advantages she'd need. It wasn't a knife. Not exactly. It was shaped like an arrowhead, like something 8 Antidote had seen in historical hollows about pre-spaceflight humans and how they killed each other. But it was big. Big as a palm and made of a dark, brassy metal. The moonlight caught the edge of it. It looked rusted. It wasn't rusted. It was stained. Blood, old enough it should have flaked off. 19 Ads held it out to him. Go on, she said. Take it. He did. It was heavy. It had been coated with some kind of thin, clear lacquer, which kept the blood on. A memory, then. The tip of a spear, like the points of the Sun Spear throne. Down the center of it was a raised part, like a spine, and when he ran his thumb over that ridge, he could feel indentations. He pressed down on the deepest one. A thin panel of the metal spine slid soundlessly back, and inside was a hologram. Like the entire object was a giant infofiche stick, and he'd just broken it open. It was an image. Very small, without any glyph annotations. But 8 Antidote could recognize it clearly. There was his ancestor the Emperor,
middle-aged, strong, with his hair unbound and reaching almost to his hips, sitting on a four-legged animal. A horse, he remembered. That's a horse, or else a camel, but I think it's a horse. And next to him, on another horse, was 19 ads, in the uniform of a soldier in the 3rd Legion. No rank marks at all. 8 Antidote wasn't that good at judging ages, but he thought she might have been 20, at most. They were both laughing in the hollow, like they shared a secret. 19 ads had a long stick with a metal point on the end in her hand, and there was blood dripping down it, and blood on her forehead in the shape of the Emperor's fingers, like he'd dipped them in an enemy and pressed them there. It was the same spear point on that stick that 8 Antidote was holding now, he was absolutely sure. "Why are you showing me this?" he asked. The Emperor didn't smile. She came to the edge of the bed and sat down on it instead. Her weight hardly disturbed it. For the first time, 8 Antidote thought of her as narrow. Unfashionably tall, but in the full imperial regalia, she always seemed broad-shouldered, strong. But here she was, feather-light, like a ghost in the moonshine from the window. "Because I loved your ancestor, 8 Antidote. I would have died for him in his service. See us there. I don't know anything of the next 30 years there. Not what I would do, or what he would do, or what he'd ask of me. But I already knew that I believed in his Tixkalan, in an empire strong enough to be at peace, if only we could build that strength high enough. And we did. We did for decades, built it and held it. It didn't last, 8 Antidote said. He couldn't look at her while he said that, only at the tiny hologram emperor, unstained with sheets of his own sacrificed blood. 30 years away from that blood, and still 8 Antidote could almost see it, how it would look. It would get all over the horse. "Nothing does," 19 ads told him, which was awful, especially because she said it with such flat, resigned finality, a true thing, from the land of being a grown-up, from the land of being emperor. "But I still believe in that Tixkalan. When Sixth Direction made me emperor in the Sun Temple, he entrusted that Tixkalan to me, and to you, after me." "I'm 11, said 8 Antidote, as if he could make her go away by saying it. He held on to the metal memory spear so hard his knuckles were white. The tiny hologram wavered, stabilized. "You're 11, little spy," 19 ads agreed and sighed. "You're 11 and you're not Sixth Direction, no matter what your face looks like. I made sure you didn't have to be." Her mouth twisted. "Sometimes I'm amazed that Sixth Direction handed me Tixkalan after I made sure of that, after what I did to make sure of it." "But I know you're not him, 8 Antidote. I know that quite definitively." He wanted to ask her, "What did you do? What did you do to make you look like that, when you say so? What might have happened to me if you hadn't?" He couldn't find his voice. "Which is why we won't be friends the way your ancestor and I were friends," she went on. "And you are 11. But you're involved already. A kid who finds his way into the Ministry of War and extracts a promise from 3 Azimuth is a politician, even if he's a kid. You know that." "I know," 8 Antidote said, very quietly. "I'm sorry I went."
"Oh, blood and stars, don't be," said 19 ads, brisk. "I'd rather have a clever, annoying, interesting successor than a dullard or a bore. How else are we going to build your ancestors' Tixkalan?" She was using the collective plural, like they were equals, like they were grown adults and she trusted him. It probably wasn't true, but he didn't know why she'd say it if she was lying to him, or keeping him from knowing something he was too young to know. He asked,
Aren't we at war, Your Brilliance? How can we have Six Directions Empire of Peace if we're fighting these aliens?
We can't, 19 Ads agreed. So we're going to have to win, or we're going to have to change the parameters of the conflict.
Three Azimuth projections make winning look
unlikely, yes, I've heard, in detail.
Here's what I want you to do for me, little spy, little successor. You hold on to this spearhead, and you look at it when you aren't sure what your emperor wants for you. You remember what I've said tonight, and you go into the Ministry of War and find out for me what is happening there. Find out why 11 Laurel is so interested in you. Find out if 3 Azimuth means to win this war, or if she wants to maintain a permanent state of conflict. Be you, exactly as you have been. But pay attention. 8 Antidote felt like his tongue had gone numb, and his fingers. His heart was thrumming. He didn't know why 3 Azimuth wouldn't want to win a war. Wasn't that what ministers of war were for? Winning takes Kalan's battles? But he managed to nod. How could he not nod? And clutch the spearhead to his chest.
Good, said the Emperor. Now go back to sleep. You are only 11. You get to sleep for a while yet. She reached out, touched his cheek with cool fingertips. A kind, small touch. And then she got up and left. The door to his rooms irised shut behind her with the faintest of clicks. 8 Antidote didn't sleep at all. He watched the dawn come up instead, glittering through the hologram, making his dead ancestor look transfigured, sunlit, like a god. After Paloa II, there were funeral orations every few hours. 9 Hibiscus kept the old tradition of a fleet-wide broadcast on a seldom-used frequency, a recitation of the names of the dead. When the 10th Legion wasn't in active combat, it sang its way through 1,000 years of previous casualties, cycling every week and a half from the most recent fallen soldiers in the Legion to the very first Teixkalan Litzlem, who had died wearing this uniform. 9 Hibiscus couldn't forget his name, or the low tone it was sung on during the litany. Tu Choya. A spear name, all cactus needles, a name that would have sounded very fine with Captain or Ikantlos in front of it. Tu Choya had died 1,000 years ago at 17, before any titles or ranks could accrue around his name. There were a lot of names that came after his. During active combat, the funeral frequency stopped playing its endless loop of memory and broadcast actual funeral orations, however small and paltry they ended up being. A snatch of song, the sound of blood falling into a bowl, and on to the next. They were happening so fast because something about what 16 Moonrise had done on Paloa II had woken up the aliens and set them to full alert. They hadn't entirely engaged the fleet yet. They were still testing the edges. The edges were mostly 16 Moonrise's people, the 24th, and a few of 40 Oxide's 17th Legion, who had been positioned on the far left of the fleet's current arrangement. The enemy liked the left flank. 9 Hibiscus was beginning to think that somewhere beyond the blackout communication silence, in the dark places between this sector's thin stars, there was a base, or at least a large collection of ships that she couldn't see, somewhere to the left of Wait for the Wheel. She'd expected consequences for retaking Paloa II. It had been a statement. We are here. This planet and these people were ours, and are ours again. Paloa is inside the world. Paloa is Teixkalan. Fuck off. Of course there would be consequences. But somehow she hadn't been mentally prepared for the enemy. Bloody stars. But she needed a better name for them than the enemy or the aliens. The Information Ministry diplomat couldn't get here fast enough to tell her what they called themselves, deciding that attrition was the better part of valor. After the scorched, eviscerated planetary corpse of Paloa II, she'd been convinced that these aliens were nihilistic, resource-destroying, and covetous of territory, more than power or colonization. But attrition, picking at the edges of the fleet, at the few ships which 16 Moonrise had sent out to do reconnoitering, that was something else. That was something smart. Letting the vast tide of Takes Kalan find no purchase, no solid targets. Only funerals. 6 so far today. 2 Shard pilots and the 4-person crew of one of 40 Oxide's scout gunners. She watched the replay of the death of that ship on Hollow. The aliens hadn't bothered with their ship-dissolving spit. They'd simply appeared. With the peculiar vision distortion that accompanied the end of their cloaking system, and tore the ship to pieces with energy weapon fire. The pilot and his crew hadn't even had time to react before they were burnt and shattered. Which of course meant that those 3-ringed prowling alien ships could be anywhere. There were too many deaths. Every time she dipped into Shard sight, she saw another one, another Takes Kalanlitslum gone dark. Felt an echo of the collective flinch, the sharpness of grief, the deeper burn of fury. That we could so easily be lost. How dare these enemies act with such impunity? All that, and a scrim afterimage of each death. She wondered how much worse it would be for the Shard pilots who had proprioception as well as visual linkage. Much worse. Almost certainly. She was going to have to move with overwhelming force and soon, and still blind. Overwhelm them wherever they were. 20 Cicada tapped her on the shoulder, and she startled, spun on him, had her hand up to shove him in the throat and away, as if they were in a sparring ring. She hadn't reacted like that in years. He backed off, his hands up.
Malo,
he said, so soft. Her cadet nickname, when she'd been softer. No one else would remember it now, let alone use it to such effect. Shame was a slow surge. So was the distant fear that she was not in control of herself or of this fleet. I'm sorry, she said. I wasn't expecting you. He shook himself, an infinitesimal shuddering resettlement of shoulders. Straightened the collar of his uniform back to regulation perfect, smiled at her, a flicker of widened eyes, curving mouth.
You were listening to the funerals, he said,
which was a way of forgiving her.
I would have been startled too.
They do keep going, said Nine Hibiscus. I should turn it off, or at least down, and actually get some work done.
Our casualty rates are too high, 20 Cicada agreed. We can't wait much longer. Losing our most adventurous and fastest ships is rotting morale, Yautlek. We need to do something.
You sound like 16 Moonrise. 20 Cicada winced.
I wish I didn't, but what we are up against is an obscenity, and our people know it. They need to stop having to see it, be hurt by it, and not strike back.
We still don't know what's out there, Nine Hibiscus said, hating the bitterness in her own voice. I can commit the fleet to all-out attack, but if we go into a slaughtering field without supplies and reinforcements...
They'd go for you.
Everyone on this ship. I know, Nine Hibiscus said. That was the problem. 20 Cicada nodded. A short acknowledgement, but didn't stop talking.
Trust is not an endlessly renewable resource. Loyalty might be, for longer. Especially when we are up against something that doesn't even bother to use what it takes.
I think they do. I think we just don't understand how yet.
I don't want to understand how what they did to Paloa 2 is useful, said 20 Cicada, as softly as when he'd said her old nickname. I think understanding would stain me indelibly.
How could she even answer that? She shrugged, her hands open.
I won't wait much longer. I promise.
Just until the envoy came. She was supposed to be arriving on the Jasmine Throat, scheduled for 2 shifts from now. That was only
Oh,
4 more funerals away. The inside of the jasmine throat was shocking, like being thrown into thick humidity after a long time in clear, processed air. Not that there was any discernible difference to Mahit in the actual atmosphere. The jasmine throat was a spacecraft, and it was precisely climate-controlled and oxygen-regulated like every other spacecraft, including LaSalle Station itself. The difference was that it was Teixkalanli. The walls were metal and plastisteel, yes, but covered in inlays of gold and green and rich pinks. All the formality and structure of a military supply ship layered over with Teixkalanli symbolism. Green things, growing things, bright stars, flowers. Fuck, how could she have forgotten flowers everywhere? White jasmine patterns painted on the ceiling of the hangar bay, the Teixkalanlitzlem dressed in gray and gold fleet uniforms, cloud hooks over every eye. No wonder she felt like she was breathing heavy air.
Welcome back,
3 Seagrass said, still a step behind her and to the left, as they exited the shuttle and made their way through the hangar toward the passenger deck. That achingly familiar positioning.
Or, welcome to the war?
She hadn't said much to Mahit the entire time they'd been in transit to the jasmine throat. Just looked at her and murmured,
that was interesting.
And shut up. A silent flame-orange presence takes Kalanli blank. They'd both thought the encounter with Amnad Bhatt was going to have ended differently, Mahit suspected, and neither of them was sure why it hadn't. It made for uncomfortable company. Neither of them knew how to talk about a disaster that hadn't been a disaster, not without explaining to each other why it might have been disastrous. And explaining felt too dangerous to Mahit, probably to 3 Seagrass as well. Now, having arrived on the jasmine throat proper, with 2 jump gates and the sublight crawl between them's worth of travel time before they came to the fleet, call it 7 hours subjective time, Mahit realized that she and 3 Seagrass were going to have to start all over again. Back to the beginning. Back to, let's assume that I'm not going to try to sabotage you, and let's assume I'm not an idiot. It seemed a long distance to fall back, especially since she was, possibly nothing, nothing was decided, she kept telling herself that, or telling Yaskander that, to stave off the stabs of neuropathic pain radiating through her palms. The saboteur, this time. And 3 Seagrass had never been an idiot. When they weren't thinking about Dash Taratz, Yaskander was a quiet, humming, pleased presence in the back of her mind. He'd never been on a Teixkalanli military ship, neither supply line reinforcement nor attack vessel, and Mahit leaned into his intent and curious observation with some relief. She needed that. She needed anything that would remind her that this experience was new, and not quite a return. Not in any sense a coming home. We are not at the war yet, she told 3 Seagrass. We have half a day before the war happens to us. We should get ready for it.
Fuck, but I missed you, said 3 Seagrass, with a sort of regret that Mahit couldn't place. Someone else who throws themselves at problems.
Mahit could feel the ghost with them then, as abrupt and clear as any other realization of political loyalties, secret alliances. The missing third person. 12 Azalea was 3 months dead and interred with the rest of the Information Ministry's fallen officers behind a plaque down on the city, an unfathomable distance away from the two of them. The one of us who was practical at all, she thought, and then revised, no, the one 3 Seagrass needed to keep her steady. I've never had a friend like that, or lost one either.
Tell me the problem, then, Mahit said. Aside from, we have to talk to aliens, and you missed me.
They were walking past a multitude of Teixkalanli soldiers, all of whom seemed unabashed in their willingness to stare at an information envoy and a barbarian.
That's really the sum of the problem, 3 Seagrass said. Those two. The aliens are a bit more pressing. Also, I could add that you seem to have made many enemies while you were visiting your station.
That's not a current problem, Mahit said, as serene as she could manage.
Ah, so we are going to be Taratz's agent. I was beginning to wonder if you'd simply confess to her.
Like I said before, Yaskander, if I was going to give us up to Tixkalan, it would take a lot more than some political pressure.
She didn't feel as brave as she sounded. She knew he knew that. He was inside her endocrine system, party to the thousand messages of her neurotransmitters and her glands.
He knew precisely how neatly Dash Taratz had trapped her. Make sure Tixkalan remains endlessly at war, or be subject to Heritage's plans, one or the other. So far, all she'd done was fail to mention Taratz's orders. That wasn't very much of being his agent, but it left all the doors of future action open. Keeping secrets always did.
If you say it's not a current problem, fine, 3Seagrass said, dryly, and opened a door to the tiny transit chamber, hardly larger than the Renton office they'd been in on LaSalle, which they had been assigned for the duration of the trip. It had no windows. Mahit wasn't terribly interested in seeing the distortion of space around a jump gate, but she still felt obscurely disappointed that she wouldn't be able to. With the door shut behind them, there was nothing between her and 3Seagrass, but 3 months of time, an envoy's uniform, and deep suspicion. 3Seagrass set her luggage down beside the door and knelt to rummage in it. She came up again with her hands full of infofiche sticks, the simple industrial-gray plastic kind, stamped with the Information Ministry seal in cheery and threatening coral orange.
Surely, Mahit found herself saying, you can't have brought along the unanswered mail. I swear I had it forwarded when I left. I've been working on it.
She was rewarded by 3Seagrass laughing, and a brief, utterly pleasant relaxation of all the tension months apart had somehow engendered.
No, said 3Seagrass. I don't have a scrap of mail for you. What I have is all the records the Yautlek in charge of the fleet has of our mysterious and very dangerous aliens. I haven't had a chance to look at them yet. Want to see?
Yes, murmured Yaskander, covetous, excited, exactly the same as Mahit was. Acquisitiveness, a certain degree of xenophilia, that showed up in both of their aptitudes. It was a central part of their compatibility. Show me something new.
Let's figure out what we're learning to talk to, she said to 3Seagrass, and took the first of the infofiche sticks from her hand, snapping it open easily between her fingers. It was audio only. It was... fuck! It was like Mahit had carved a hole in the world between the space of one side of the infofiche stick and the other, and on the inside was static and screaming, or static that was screaming, or... she felt ill. There didn't seem to be a way to turn it off. 3Seagrass had gone gray-green under the warm brown of her skin. It made her look dead or dying, or like she wanted to be dead or dying. And yet, there were different terrible sounds in the audio recording. A stuttering shriek that was repeated 3 times, a lower buzz that roiled Mahit's stomach and occurred after every pause longer than 10 seconds. She couldn't understand it, and it was hideous. But it wasn't noise. When the recording was finally over, both she and 3Seagrass were breathing in hyperventilating gasps, huge snatches of air to shove back the nausea. They stared at each other.
I don't know if it's language, Mahit managed, finally. But it's definitely communication. Phonemes or... I don't think it's words, it's not enough differentiation, but... maybe tone markers?
3Seagrass nodded, swallowed like she was forcing back bile, and nodded again, more firmly.
Horrible sick-making tone markers. Got it. I want to cross-reference it to the readout from the ship that recorded the transmission. They were interacting with it somehow. Maybe we can map which noise goes with what.
If either of us vomits, we should vomit in a bin, Mahit said.
Do we have a bin? Are any more of these audio only?
She gestured at Three Seagrass's fistful of infofiche sticks.
Only one was marked for audio. The rest should be visual and text, said Three Seagrass. Open them up, and I'll go find two bins. This is a resupply vessel. I'm sure they've got bins.
Probably also bin liners. We're going to have to listen to that. A lot.
Bleeding sunlight,
Three Seagrass cursed. But she was smiling, stationer style, the edges of her teeth showing. Mahit felt charmed, and worried at being charmed, and utterly relieved that, given work to do, the two of them were apparently fine with one another.
Bin liners, excellent. 7 hours is plenty of time to categorize our tone markers by how many bin liners listening to them requires.
Wouldn't want you to look bad in front of the Yautlek, Mahit said. She'll want the bin liner report straight away, and presumably the rest of the report also.
See?
Said Three Seagrass, still smiling that almost stationer smile.
I knew fetching a barbarian diplomat who could learn our language would save me time in learning someone else's.
She slipped out the door before Mahit could ask her the questions on the tip of her tongue. Would you be as fascinated with these aliens as you have been with me? Considering we are all barbarians? Even if I am as human as you are?
Better not to ask, Yaskander told her. You don't really want to know the answer anyhow.
In poetry and epics, and even in statecraft manuals of the driest and most clinical kind, emperors were exempt from sleep, or ought to be, and therefore so were starship captains. Nine Hibiscus had always thought that a Yautlek, who was somewhere in between captain and emperor, really ought to develop the ability to stay awake indefinitely upon receiving her spear arc collar tabs. Practicality, however, had a notorious way of ignoring poetry, epics, and statecraft manuals. Like everyone else on wait for the wheel, Nine Hibiscus had a designated 8-hour shift for sleeping. Lately, she wasn't very good at it, which said something about emperors and Yautlekim, and the difference between being in charge of one small but powerful thing, like a starship, and a whole lot of disparate things, like a fleet full of Tixkalanlitzlum all ready to die for the sake of the Empire, and at her command. Nine Hibiscus had been trying to sleep. She had removed her uniform and laid herself down on her bed in an undershirt and sleeping shorts and cued her cloud hook to dim the room lights to almost blackout. She'd even set her messages to silent, save for absolute priority. If the aliens attacked wait for the wheel, she'd wake up, but probably not for anything else. If she ever went to sleep at all anyway. She'd been trying for a full third of her 8 hours and had gotten nowhere. All she could think about was the flashfire deaths of the shards, about whether the new biofeedback technology was worth giving half the fleet post-traumatic flashbacks when someone half a sector away died badly. Cost-benefit analysis was antithetical to sleeping. It was a relief when someone physically knocked on her door. Most likely they'd been trying to send a non-priority message and hadn't heard from her, and now something was happening, and she didn't have to pretend she was sleeping any longer. She raised the lights and wriggled into her trousers for a modicum of authority and waved the door open. On the other side, looking apologetic, was her chief communications officer, Two Foam. This wasn't one of Two Foam's off shifts. The bridge took careful and staggered turns, and when Nine Hibiscus was sleeping, Two Foam was usually awake. But she looked exhausted anyhow, even if she hadn't been woken up. Yautlek, she said. There's been a major development. The crew of Wait for the Wheel called Two Foam Bubbles, because she wasn't bubbly at all. The nickname was ubiquitous. Even Nine Hibiscus had to remember not to use it. Instead, she waved her inside her quarters without using any name in particular and let the door shut behind her. Her own heart rate had kicked up. This was better than sleep. This was the shimmer focus of being responsible in a crisis. Yes? What sort of development that is significant enough for you to come fetch me?
Tufome didn't seem particularly comfortable standing in her superior officer's quarters, while said superior officer found the other pieces of her uniform and put them back on. Nevertheless, she gamely directed her eyes toward the ceiling and explained, "Sir, we have one of the aliens."
"What? Alive? Did we capture a ship?"
Tufome shook her head. "Dead. A shard from the 17th found it floating in vacuum after one of the engagements we've been having. He lassoed it and brought it back."
Nine Hibiscus felt shaky with exhilaration. She had to exert effort to keep a visible tremor out of her hands.
"Get that soldier a commendation. From 40 Oxide if you can manage it. It should come from his own fleet, Captain, and where is it? The alien?"
"In the medical bay," said Tufome. "The medtechs are going to autopsy it, but I thought you might want to see it first."
"Fuck yes I do," said Nine Hibiscus and slammed her feet into her boots. "Let's go."
Medical was two decks up and in the rear of the ship. They made the 15-minute walk in 10, and Nine Hibiscus took a deep, brief pleasure in how Bubbles kept pace with her, a half step behind to her left. It made her feel like something was right in the universe, and she was going to need that to deal with whatever she was about to see. She was trying not to imagine it. Imagination created biases. And besides, all she could think of was a smaller human-scale version of their three-ringed ships, and that was absurd. They clearly weren't some kind of hungry ship species that butted off smaller ships. The shard pilot wouldn't have been able to bring one in if they had been. This was what imagining got her, absurdities. Comforting absurdities. She suspected what she was going to be looking at would be much worse than anything she could come up with. But it wasn't. Which was awful. Laid out on the table, the medtechs usually used for surgery, which had been stripped of its standard padding and cushions designed to hold a human body in place, pared down to flat metal, was something that looked like an animal. Not even a horrible animal. Just a new one. They'd stripped it of its clothes, which were a deep red tactical weight cloth and looked well made. Someone would analyze them later, though the fact that it wore clothes at all was significant. But now was for the creature itself. Nine Hibiscus stepped close enough to see that it would have towered over her by a foot and a half at least when it had been alive and standing. The naked alien had four limbs, like most bipeds. The rear two were thick and short, powerful in the thighs below a long torso. The front two were overlong by human standards, with four-fingered hands that ended in blunt claws. The claws were capped, decoratively, in some kind of bright plastic shot through with silvery wires. Those might be a piloting interface, Nine Hibiscus thought, fascinated, and then kept looking, scanning up the body. The skin was mottled. It could have been trauma or vacuum chill, but she thought it was coloration, spots and blotches. And the neck. The neck was wrong. Too long. Half as long as the torso, a neck for bending and tearing, flexible, muscle-ridged, leading to a head that was all jaw, mouth open in death, a dark tongue hanging over carnivore teeth, jagged and massive. The eyes faced forward, like a human's eyes, and were sightless, clouded. The left one burst open during whatever dying had happened to it. Predator's eyes, like a human's. The ears were cups, set far back on the skull, and faintly furred. Somehow that was the worst thing about it. Those ears were like the ears of the soft, almost cat pets from Kuran, that purred and bred in the air ducts and annoyed 20 cicada. And they were on this thing, this otherwise hairless scavenger thing that was killing her fleet. "Is it a mammal?" Nine Hibiscus asked. She knew how to kill mammals. They had fairly standard physiologies. The heart, for example, was in the chest.
"It's not an insect or a reptile," said the medtech. "Probably a mammal, a male-sexed one."
He gestured. Nine Hibiscus noted the penile sheath and nodded.
"I'll know more when we open it up."
"Well then, open it up," she said,
Figure out how it works, so we can know how best to stop it from working.
Interlude. This is not the first time this has happened. The place. The depth of Bardzrovan sector, close enough to the Unhamamet gate, that the discontinuity of jump gate space begins to distort vision. Human eyes, and other eyes, any eyes that function on the old clever model of refraction and reflection, that assembly of light on a retina into image flaring between one neuron and the next. They cannot see what a jump gate does to space-time. There is an inability to assemble the light into any coherent image, a collapse of meaning. That discontinuity shivers, shudders, spreads. A portion of it sections off and moves. A ripple thrown into the black, the afterimage of a stone landing in water. The half-caught reflection of a school of fish, glinting once as light glances off their scales, and then, moving together, angling, gone, unseeable. This is not at all the first time this has happened, and the last time it did, the last time it did, in the aftermath, Dekakel Onchu held the hand of her terrified and half-dead pilot and imagined how the shimmering black between stars could resolve into hungry, lamprey mouth rings, could devour the entirety of an imago line before there was any chance of preservation of memory. The last time, there had been no steady flow of Teixkalani military vessels through the far gate. Onchu had hoped that, if Daj Taratz was using all of LaSalle Station as bait for Teixkalan, drawing the Empire through and past them into the maws of those ring ships. She'd hoped at least she wouldn't have to deal with any more ring ships eating her pilots. Hoped, and is now denied even that. The message comes in bright and hot, a desperate, breathless cry over long-range broadcast. They hide in the jump gate! They look like the jump gate. They're after me. I'm not fast enough. And Onchu, sitting in the nexus of pilot's command, for her the true heart of LaSalle, no matter what heritage believed about their room repository of Imago machines, Onchu, sitting there, has to ask her pilot to not come home, to not lead that hungry thing that Taratz thinks could devour an empire back to the fragile shell of LaSalle Station. It is the worst thing she's ever done. When she dies, she will die thinking of it, like a splinter finally reaching her heart after years of worming its way through flesh. Over that long-range broadcast, she says, "Go through the jump gate. If they're chasing you, make them chase you. Zo'unjat," her pilot's name, or that pilot's imago's name, in these moments, she slips. She has known so many of her people in all their iterations. "I am with you. LaSalle is with you. Take them through the jump gate, and hope the Empire is on the other side to catch you. I'll be listening." She does not receive an answer aside from a positional ping, a small shift in that discontinuity around the far gate. Zo'unjat and her pursuer, gone over, gone entire. Dekakel Onchu is very good at listening, and she stays by her instruments for hours and hours. She never hears from Zo'unjat again. Zo'unjat, obedient and patriotic, going to her death, but not the death she expected. Teixkalan is on the other side of the Unhamamet gate, yes, but Teixkalan sees the three-ringed maw of one of their enemy's ships and cares not at all for one small patrol craft smashed in the conflagration of their energy cannon fire, cares not at all, and may not have even seen, or noticed, or thought to look, only to keep themselves safe from what appears, to the member of the 17th Legion who sees that rippling discontinuity materialize, to be a flanking ambush. And Dekakel Onchu cannot hear the singing of the we. Not at all. Not how the extinguishing of the voices on that ring ship does not alter the volume of the song, but only its shape.
She thinks language. After all, she thinks language and finds herself ragged with tears, waiting for voices that will never come to her. Not once, while she is alive.